Mother Night, written by Kurt Vonnegut.
Chapter 1. Tiglath-Pileser III. My name is Howard W. Campbell, Jr. I am an American by birth, a Nazi by reputation, and a nationless person by inclination. The year in which I write this book is 1961. I address this book of mine to Mr. Tuvia Friedman, director of the Haifa Institute for the Documentation of War Criminals, and to whomever else this may concern. Why should this book interest Mr. Friedman? Because it is written by a man suspected of being a war criminal. Mr. Friedman is a specialist in such persons. He had expressed an eagerness to have any writings I might care to add to his archives of Nazi villainy. He is so eager as to give me a typewriter, free stenographic service, and the use of research assistants who will run down any facts I may need in order to make my account complete and accurate. I am behind bars. I am behind bars in a nice new jail in Old Jerusalem. I am awaiting a fair trial for my war crimes by the Republic of Israel. It is a curious typewriter Mr. Friedman has given to me. An appropriate typewriter, too. It is a typewriter that was obviously made in Germany during the Second World War. How can I tell? Quite simply, for it puts at fingertips a symbol that was never used on a typewriter before the Third German Reich, a symbol that will never be used on a typewriter again. The symbol is the twin lightning strokes used for the dreaded SS, the Schutzstaffel, the most fanatical wing of Nazism. I used such a typewriter in Germany all through the war. Whenever I had occasion to write of the Schutzstaffel, which I did often and with enthusiasm, I never abbreviated it as SS, but always struck the typewriter key for the far more frightening and magical twin lightning strokes. Ancient history. I am surrounded by ancient history. Though the jail in which I rot is new, some of the stones in it, I'm told, were cut in the time of King Solomon. And sometimes, when I look out through my cell window at the gay and brassy youth of the infant Republic of Israel, I feel that I and my war crimes are as ancient as Solomon's old gray stones. How long ago that war, that Second World War, was. How long ago the crimes in it. How nearly forgotten it is, even by the Jews, the young Jews, that is. One of the Jews who guards me here knows nothing about that war. He is not interested. His name is Arnold Marx. He has very red hair. He is only 18, which means Arnold was 3 when Hitler died, and non-existent when my career as a war criminal began. He guards me from 6 in the morning until noon. Arnold was born in Israel. He has never been outside of Israel. His mother and father left Germany in the early 30s. His grandfather, he told me, won an Iron Cross in the First World War. Arnold is studying to be a lawyer. The avocation of Arnold and of his father, a gunsmith, is archaeology. Father and son spend most all their spare time excavating the ruins of Hazor. They do so under the direction of Yigael Yadin, who was chief of staff of the Israeli army during the war with the Arab states. So be it. Hazor, Arnold tells me, was a Canaanite city in northern Palestine that existed at least 1900 years before Christ. About 1400 years before Christ, Arnold tells me, an Israelite army captured Hazor, killed all 40,000 inhabitants, and burned it down. Solomon rebuilt the city, said Arnold, but in 732 BC, Tiglath-Pileser III burned it down again. Who? I said. Tiglath-Pileser III, said Arnold. The Assyrian, he said, giving my memory a nudge. Oh, I said, that Tiglath-Pileser. You act as though you never heard of him, said Arnold. I never have, I said. I shrugged humbly. I guess that's pretty terrible. Well, said Arnold, giving me a schoolmaster's frown. It seems to me he really is somebody everybody ought to know about. He was probably the most remarkable man the Assyrians ever produced. Oh, I said. I'll bring you a book about him if you like, said Arnold. That's nice of you, I said. Maybe I'll get around to thinking about remarkable Assyrians later on. Right now my mind is pretty well occupied with remarkable Germans. Like who? He said. Oh, I've been thinking a lot lately about my old boss, Paul Joseph Goebbels, I said. Arnold looked at me blankly. Who? He said. And I felt the dust of the Holy Land creeping in to bury me, sensed how thick a dust and rubble blanket I would one day wear. I felt 30 or 40 feet of ruined cities above me. Beneath me, some primitive kitchen middens, a temple or two, and then Tiglath-Pileser III. Chapter 2. Special Detail. The guard who relieves Arnold Marx at noon each day is a man nearly my own age, which is 48. He remembers the war all right, though he doesn't like to. His name is Andor Gutman. Andor is a sleepy, not very bright, Estonian Jew. He spent 2 years in the extermination camp at Auschwitz. According to his own reluctant account, he came this close to going up a smokestack of a crematorium there. I had just been assigned to the Sonderkommando, he said to me, when the order came from Himmler to close the ovens down. Sonderkommando means special detail. At Auschwitz, it meant a very special detail indeed, one composed of prisoners whose duties were to shepherd condemned prisoners into gas chambers and then to lug their bodies out. When the job was done, the members of the Sonderkommando were themselves killed. The first duty of their successors was to dispose of their remains. Gutman told me that many men actually volunteered for the Sonderkommando. Why? I asked him. If you would write a book about that, he said, and give the answer to that question, that why, you would have a very great book. Do you know the answer? I said. No, he said. That is why I would pay a great deal of money for a book with the answer in it. Any guesses? I said. No, he said, looking me straight in the eye, even though I was one of the ones who volunteered. He went away for a little while, after having confessed that, and he thought about Auschwitz, the thing he liked least to think about, and he came back and he said to me, there were loudspeakers all over the camp, he said, and they were never silent for long. There was much music played through them. Those who were musical told me it was often good music, sometimes the best. That's interesting, I said. There was no music by Jews, he said. That was forbidden. Naturally, I said. And the music was always stopping in the middle, he said. And then there was an announcement. All day long, music and announcements. Very modern, I said. He closed his eyes, remembered gropingly. There was one announcement that was always crooned, like a nursery rhyme. Many times a day it came. It was the call for the Sonderkommando. Oh, I said. Leichenträger zur Wache. He crooned, his eyes still closed. Translation? Corpse carriers to the guardhouse. In an institution in which the purpose was to kill human beings by the millions, it was an understandably common cry. After 2 years of hearing that call over the loudspeakers, between the music, Gutman said to me, the position of corpse carrier suddenly sounded like a very good job. I can understand that, I said. You can? He said. He shook his head. I can't, he said. I will always be ashamed. Volunteering for the Sonderkommando, It was a very shameful thing to do. I don't think so, I said. I do, he said. Shameful, he said. I never want to talk about it again. Chapter 3. Briquettes. The guard who relieves Andor Gutman at 6 each night is Arpad Kovacs. Arpad is a Roman candle of a man, loud and gay. When Arpad came on duty at 6 last night, he demanded to see what I'd written so far. I gave him the very few pages, and Arpad walked up and down the corridor, waving and praising the pages extravagantly. He didn't read them. He praised them for what he imagined to be in them. "Give it to the complacent bastards," he said last night. "Tell those smug briquettes." By briquettes he meant people who did nothing to save their own lives or anybody else's life when the Nazis took over, who were willing to go meekly all the way to the gas chambers, if that was where the Nazis wanted them to go. A briquette, of course, is a molded block of coal dust, the soul of convenience where transportation, storage, and combustion are concerned. Arpad, faced with the problem of being a Jew in Nazi Hungary, did not become a briquette. On the contrary, Arpad got himself false papers and joined the Hungarian SS. That fact is the basis for his sympathy with me. "Tell them the things a man does to stay alive. What's so noble about being a briquette?" he said last night. "Did you ever hear any of my broadcasts?" I asked him. The medium of my war crimes was radio broadcasting. I was a Nazi radio propagandist, a shrewd and loathsome anti-Semite. "No," he said. So I showed him a transcript of a broadcast, a transcript furnished to me by the Haifa Institute. "Read it," I said. "I don't have to," he said. "Everybody was saying the same things over and over and over in those days." "Read it anyway, as a favor," I said. So he read it, his face becoming sourer and sourer. He handed it back to me. "You disappoint me," he said. "Oh," I said. "It's so weak," he said. "It has no body, no paprika, no zest. I thought you were a master of racial invective." "I'm not," I said. "If any member of my SS platoon had spoken in such a friendly way about the Jews," said Arpad, "I would have had him shot for treason. Goebbels should have fired you and hired me as the radio scourge of the Jews. I would have raised blisters around the world." "You are already doing your part with your SS platoon," I said. Arpad beamed, remembering his SS days. "What an Aryan I made," he said. "Nobody ever suspected you?" I said. "How would they dare?" he said. "I was such a pure and terrifying Aryan that they even put me in a special detachment. Its mission was to find out how the Jews always knew what the SS was going to do next. There was a leak somewhere, and we were out to stop it." He looked bitter and affronted, remembering it, even though he had been that leak. "Was the detachment successful in its mission?" I said. "I'm happy to say," said Arpad, "that 14 SS men were shot on our recommendation. Adolf Eichmann himself congratulated us." "You met him, did you?" I said. "Yes," said Arpad. "And I'm sorry I didn't know at the time how important he was." "Why?" I said. "I would have killed him," said Arpad. Chapter 4. Leather Straps. Bernard Mengel, a Polish Jew who guards me from midnight until 6 in the morning, is also a man my age. He once saved his own life in the Second World War by playing so dead that a German soldier pulled out 3 of his teeth without suspecting that Mengel was not a corpse. The soldier wanted Mengel's 3 gold inlays. He got them. Mengel tells me that I sleep very noisily here in jail. tossing and talking all night. "You are the only man I ever heard of," Mangle said to me this morning, "who has a bad conscience about what he did in the war. Everybody else, no matter what side he was on, no matter what he did, is sure a good man could not have acted in any other way." "What makes you think I have a bad conscience?" I said.
"The way you sleep, the way you dream," he said. "Even Hurst does not sleep like that. He slept like a saint right up to the end."
Mangle was speaking of Rudolf Franz Höss, the commandant of the extermination camp at Auschwitz. In his tender care, literally millions of Jews were gassed. Mangle knew a little about Höss. Before emigrating to Israel in 1947, Mangle helped to hang Höss. And he didn't do it with testimony either. He did it with his two big hands.
"When Höss was hanged," he told me, "the strap around his ankles, I put that on and made it tight."
"Did that give you a lot of satisfaction?" I said.
"No,"
he said.
"I was like almost everybody who came through that war."
"What do you mean?" I said.
"I got so I couldn't feel anything," said Mangle. "Every job was a job to do, and no job was any better or any worse than any other. After we finished hanging Höss," Mangle said to me, "I packed up my clothes to go home. The catch on my suitcase was broken, so I buckled it shut with a big leather strap. Twice within an hour, I did the very same job. Once to Höss, and once to my suitcase. Both jobs felt about the same."
Chapter 5. Last Full Measure. I too knew Rudolf Höss, commandant of Auschwitz. I met him at a New Year's Eve party in Warsaw during the war, the start of 1944. Höss heard that I was a writer, and he got me to one side at the party, and he said he wished he could write. "How I envy you creative people," he said to me. "Creativity is a gift from the gods." Höss said he had some marvelous stories to tell. He said they were all true, but that people wouldn't be able to believe them. Höss could not tell me the stories, he said, until the war was won. After the war, he said, we might collaborate. "I can talk it," he said, "but I can't write it." He looked to me for pity. "When I sit down to write," he said, "I freeze." What was I doing in Warsaw? I had been ordered there by my boss, Reichsleiter Dr. Paul Joseph Goebbels, head of the German Ministry of Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda. I had a certain amount of skill as a dramatist, and Dr. Goebbels wanted me to use it. Dr. Goebbels wanted me to write a pageant honoring the German soldiers who had given their last full measure of devotion, who had died, that is, in putting down the uprising of the Jews in the Warsaw ghetto. Dr. Goebbels had a dream of producing the pageant annually in Warsaw after the war, of letting the ruins of the ghetto stand forever as a setting for it. "There would be Jews in the pageant?" I asked him.
"Certainly," he said, "thousands of them."
"May I ask, sir," I said, "where you expect to find any Jews after the war?" He saw the humor in this.
"A very good question," he said, chuckling. "We'll have to take that up with Höss," he said.
"With whom?" I said. I hadn't yet been to Warsaw, hadn't yet met with Brother Höss.
"He's running a little health resort for Jews in Poland," said Goebbels. "We must be sure to ask him to save us some."
Can the writing of this ghastly pageant be added to the list of my war crimes? No, thank God. It never got much beyond having a working title, which was Last Full Measure. I am willing to admit, however, that I probably would have written it if there had been enough time, if my superiors had put enough pressure on me. Actually, I am willing to admit almost anything. About this pageant, it had one peculiar result. It brought the Gettysburg Address of Abraham Lincoln to the attention of Goebbels, and then to the attention of Hitler himself.
Goebbels asked me where I'd gotten the working title. So I made a translation for him of the entire Gettysburg Address. He read it, his lips moving all the time. "You know," he said to me, "this is a very fine piece of propaganda. We are never as modern, as far ahead of the past as we like to think we are." "It's a very famous speech in my native land," I said. "Every schoolchild has to learn it by heart." "Do you miss America?" he said. "I miss the mountains, the rivers, the broad plains, the forests," I said. "But I could never be happy with the Jews in charge of everything." "They will be taken care of in due time," he said. "I live for that day. My wife and I live for that day," I said. "How is your wife?" he said. "Blooming, thank you," I said. "A beautiful woman," he said. "I'll tell her you said so," I said. "It will please her immensely." "About the speech by Abraham Lincoln," he said. "Sir," I said. "There are phrases in here that might be used most impressively in dedications of German military cemeteries," he said. "I haven't been happy at all, frankly, with most of our funeral oratory. This seems to have the extra dimension I've been looking for. I'd like very much to send this to Hitler." "Whatever you say, sir," I said. "Lincoln wasn't a Jew, was he?" he said. "I'm sure not," I said. "It would be very embarrassing to me if he turned out to be one," he said. "I've never heard anyone suggest that he was," I said. "The name Abraham is very suspicious, to say the least," said Goebbels. "I'm sure his parents didn't realize that it was a Jewish name," I said. "They must have just liked the sound of it. They were simple frontier people. If they'd known the name was Jewish, I'm sure they would have called him something more American, like George or Stanley or Fred." 2 weeks later, the Gettysburg Address came back from Hitler. There was a note from Der Führer himself stapled to the top of it. "Some parts of this," he wrote, "almost made me weep. All northern peoples are one in their deep feeling for soldiers. It is perhaps our greatest bond." Strange. I never dream of Hitler, or Goebbels, or Hoss, or Goering, or any of the other nightmare people of the World War numbered two. I dream of women instead. I asked Bernard Mengel, the guard who watches over me while I sleep here in Jerusalem, if he had any clues as to what I dreamed about. "Last night?" he said. "Any night," I said. "Last night it was women," he said. "Two names you said over and over." "What were they?" I said. "Helga was one," he said. "My wife," I said. "The other was Resi," he said. "My wife's younger sister," I said. "Just their names, that's all."
"You said goodbye," he said.
"Goodbye," I echoed. That certainly made sense, whether I dreamed it or not. Helga and Resi were both gone forever.
"And you talked about New York," said Mengel. "You mumbled, and then you said New York, and then you mumbled some more."
That made sense, too, as do most of the things I dream. I lived in New York for a long time before coming to Israel.
"New York City must be heaven," said Mengel.
"It might well be for you," I said. "It was hell for me. Or not hell, something worse than hell."
"What could be worse than hell?" he said.
"Purgatory," I said. Chapter 6. Purgatory. About that purgatory of mine in New York City. I was in it for 15 years. I disappeared from Germany at the end of the Second World War. I reappeared, unrecognized, in Greenwich Village. There I rented a depressing attic apartment, with rats squeaking and scrabbling in the walls. I continued to inhabit that attic until a month ago, when I was brought to Israel for trial.
there was one pleasant thing about my ratty attic. The back window of it overlooked a little private park, a little Eden formed by joint backyards. That park, that Eden, was walled off from the streets by houses on all sides. It was big enough for children to play hide and seek in. I often heard a cry from that little Eden, a child's cry, that never failed to make me stop and listen. It was the sweetly mournful cry that meant a game of hide and seek was over, that those still hiding were to come out of hiding, that it was time to go home. The cry was, "Ollie, ollie, oxen free!" And I, hiding from many people who might want to hurt or kill me, often longed for someone to give that cry for me, to end my endless game of hide and seek with a sweet and mournful, "Ollie, ollie, oxen free!" Chapter 7. Autobiography. I, Howard W. Campbell, Jr., was born in Schenectady, New York, on February 16, 1912. My father, who was raised in Tennessee, the son of a Baptist minister, was an engineer in the Service Engineering Department of the General Electric Company. The mission of the Service Engineering Department was to install, maintain, and repair General Electric heavy equipment sold anywhere in the world. My father, whose assignments were at first only in the United States, was rarely home. And his job demanded such varied forms of technical cleverness of him that he had scant time and imagination left over for anything else. The man was the job, and the job was the man. The only non-technical book I ever saw him look at was a picture history of the First World War. It was a big book, with pictures a foot high and a foot and a half wide. My father never seemed to tire of looking at the book, though he hadn't been in the war. He never told me what the book meant to him, and I never asked him. All he ever said to me about it was that it wasn't for children, that I wasn't to look at it. So, of course, I looked at it every time I was left alone. There were pictures of men hung on barbed wire, mutilated women, bodies stacked like cordwood, all the usual furniture of world wars. My mother was the former Virginia Crocker, the daughter of a portrait photographer from Indianapolis. She was a housewife and an amateur cellist. She played cello with the Schenectady Symphony Orchestra, and she once had dreams of my playing the cello, too. I failed as a cellist because I, like my father, am tone deaf. I had no brothers and sisters, and my father was seldom home. So I was for many years the principal companion of my mother. She was a beautiful, talented, morbid person. I think she was drunk most of the time. I remember a time when she filled a saucer with a mixture of rubbing alcohol and table salt. She put the saucer on the kitchen table, turned out all the lights, and had me sit facing her across the table. And then she touched off the mixture with a match. The flame was almost pure yellow, a sodium flame, and it made her look like a corpse to me, made me look like a corpse to her. "There," she said. "That's what we'll look like when we're dead." This queer demonstration not only scared me, it scared her too. My mother scared herself with her own queerness, and from that moment on I ceased to be her companion. From that moment on she hardly spoke to me, cut me dead, I'm sure, out of fear of doing or saying something even crazier. All that happened in Schenectady before I was 10. In 1923, when I was 11, my father was assigned to the General Electric office in Berlin, Germany. From then on, my education, my friends, and my principal language were German. I eventually became a playwright in the German language, and I took a German wife, the actress Helga Noth. Helga Noth was the elder of the two daughters of Werner Noth, the chief of police of Berlin. My father and mother left Germany in 1939, when war came. My wife and I stayed on. I earned my keep until the war ended in 1945, as a writer and broadcaster of Nazi propaganda to the English-speaking world. I was the leading expert on American problems in the Ministry of Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda. When the war was ending, I was high on the list of war criminals, largely because my offenses were so obscenely public. I was captured by one Lieutenant Bernard B. O'Hare of the American Third Army near Hirschfeld on April 12, 1945. I was on a motorcycle, unarmed. While entitled to a uniform, a blue and gold one, I was not wearing it. I was in mufti, in a blue serge suit and a moth-eaten coat with a fur collar. As it happened, the Third Army had overrun Ohrdruf, the first Nazi death camp the Americans were to see 2 days before. I was taken there, was forced to look at it all, the lime pits, the gallows, the whipping posts, at the gutted and scabby, bug-eyed, spavined dead in heaps. The idea was to show me the consequences of what I had done. The Ohrdruf gallows were capable of hanging six at a time. When I saw them, there was a dead camp guard at the end of each rope, and it was expected that I would hang soon, too. I expected it myself, and I took an interest in the peace of the six guards at the ends of their ropes. They had died fast. My photograph was taken while I looked up at the gallows. Lieutenant O'Hare was standing beside me, lean as a young wolf, as full of hatred as a rattlesnake. The picture was on the cover of Life and came close to winning a Pulitzer Prize. Chapter 8. Auf Wiedersehen. I did not hang. I committed high treason, crimes against humanity, and crimes against my own conscience, and I got away with them until now. I got away with them because I was an American agent all through the war. My broadcasts carried coded information out of Germany. The code was a matter of mannerisms, pauses, emphases, coughs, seeming stumbles in certain key sentences. Persons I never saw gave me my instructions, told me in which sentences of a broadcast the mannerisms were to appear. I do not know to this day what information went out through me. From the simplicity of most of my instructions, I gather that I was usually giving yes or no answers to questions that had been put to the spy apparatus. Occasionally, as during the build-up for the Normandy invasion, my instructions were more complicated, and my phrasing and diction sounded like the last stages of double pneumonia. That was the extent of my usefulness to the Allied cause, and that usefulness was what saved my neck. I was provided with cover. I was never acknowledged as an American agent, but the treason case against me was sabotaged. I was freed on non-existent technicalities about my citizenship, and I was helped to disappear. I came to New York under an assumed name. I started a new life, in a manner of speaking, in my ratty attic overlooking the secret park. I was left alone. So much alone that I was able to take back my own name, and almost nobody wondered if I was the Howard W. Campbell, Jr. I would occasionally find my name in a newspaper or magazine, never as an important person, but as one name in a long list of names of war criminals who had disappeared. There were rumors of me in Iran, Argentina, Ireland. Israeli agents were said to be looking high and low for me. Be that as it may, no agent ever knocked on my door. Nobody knocked on my door, even though the name on my mailbox was plain for anybody to see. Howard W. Campbell, Jr. Until the very end of my purgatory in Greenwich Village, The closest I came to being detected in my infamy was when I went to a Jewish doctor in the same building as my attic. I had an infected thumb. The doctor's name was Abraham Epstein. He lived with his mother on the second floor. They had just moved in. When I gave him my name, it meant nothing to him, but it did mean something to his mother. Epstein was young, fresh out of medical school. His mother was old, heavy, slow, deeply lined, sadly, bitterly watchful.
"That is a very famous name," she said. "You must know that."
"Pardon me," I said.
"You do not know about anybody else named Howard W. Campbell, Jr.?" she said.
"I suppose there are some others," I said.
"How old are you?" she said.
I told her.
"Then you are old enough to remember the war," she said.
"Forget the war,"
her son said to her, affectionately but sharply. He was bandaging my thumb.
"And you never heard Howard W. Campbell, Jr. broadcasting from Berlin," she said to me.
"I do remember now, yes," I said. "I'd forgotten. That was a long time ago. I never listened to him, but I remember he was in the news. Those things fade."
"They should fade," said young Dr. Epstein. "They belong to a period of insanity that should be forgotten as quickly as possible."
"Auschwitz," said his mother.
"Forget Auschwitz," said Dr. Epstein.
"Do you know what Auschwitz was?"
his mother asked me.
"Yes," I said.
"That was where I spent my young womanhood," she said. "And that was where my son, the doctor here, spent his childhood."
"I never think about it," said Dr. Epstein abruptly. "There. That thumb should be all right in a couple of days. Keep it warm, keep it dry."
And he hustled me toward the door.
"Sprechen Sie Deutsch?"
his mother called after me as I was leaving.
"Pardon me," I spoke.
"I asked if you spoke German," she said.
"Oh," I said. "No, I'm afraid not," I said. I experimented shyly with the language.
"Nein," I said.
"That's no, isn't it?"
"Very good," she said.
"Auf Wiedersehen," I said. "That's goodbye, isn't it?"
"Until we meet again," she said.
"Oh," I said. "Well, auf Wiedersehen."
"Auf Wiedersehen," she said.
Chapter 9. Enter My Blue Fairy Godmother. I was recruited as an American agent in 1938, 3 years before America got into the war. I was recruited one spring day in the Tiergarten in Berlin. I had been married to Helga Nott a month. I was 26. I was a fairly successful playwright, writing in the language in which I write best, German. I had one play, The Goblet, running in both Dresden and Berlin. Another play of mine, The Snow Rose, was then in production in Berlin. I had just finished a third one, 70x7. All three plays were medieval romances, about as political as chocolate eclairs. I was sitting alone on a park bench in the sunshine that day, thinking of a fourth play that was beginning to write itself in my mind. It gave itself a title, which was Das Reich der Zwei, Nation of Two. It was going to be about the love my wife and I had for each other. It was going to show how a pair of lovers in a world gone mad could survive by being loyal only to a nation composed of themselves, a nation of two. On a bench across the path from me, a middle-aged American now sat down. He looked like a fool and a gas bag. He untied his shoelaces to relieve his feet, and he began to read a month-old copy of the Chicago Sunday Tribune. Three handsome officers of the SS stalked down the walk between us. When they were gone, the man put his paper down
and spoke to me in twanging Chicago English.
"Nice-looking men," he said.
"I suppose," I said.
"You understand English?"
he said. "Yes," I said.
"Thank God for somebody who can understand English," he said. "I've been going crazy trying to find somebody to talk to."
"That's so," I said.
"What do you think of all this?" he said. "Or aren't people supposed to go around asking questions like that?"
"All what?" I said.
"The things going on in Germany," he said. "Hitler and the Jews and all that."
"It isn't anything I can control," I said. "So I don't think about it." He nodded.
"None of your beeswax, eh?" he said.
"Pardon me," I said.
"None of your business?" he said.
"That's right," I said.
"You didn't understand that? When I said beeswax instead of business?" he said.
"It's a common expression, is it?" I said.
"In America it is," he said. "You mind if I come over there so we don't have to holler?"
"As you please," I said.
"As you please," he echoed, coming over to my bench. "That sounds like something an Englishman would say."
"American," I said. He raised his eyebrows.
"Is that a fact? I was trying to guess what maybe you were, but I wouldn't have guessed that."
"Thank you," I said.
"You figure that's a compliment?" he said. "That's why you said thank you?"
"Not a compliment. Or an insult, either," I said. "Nationalities just don't interest me as much as they probably should." This seemed to puzzle him.
"Any of my beeswax what you do for a living?" he said.
"Writer," I said.
"Is that a fact?" he said. "That's a great coincidence. I was sitting over there wishing I could write. On account of I've thought up what I think's a pretty good spy story."
"That's so," I said.
"I might as well give it to you," he said. "I'll never write it."
"I've got all the projects I can handle now," I said.
"Well, sometime you may run dry," he said. "And then you can use this thing of mine. There's this young American, see, who's been in Germany so long he's practically a German himself. He writes plays in German, and he's married to a beautiful German actress. And he knows a lot of big-shot Nazis who like to hang around theater people."
He rattled off the names of Nazis, great and small, all of whom Helga and I knew pretty well. It wasn't that Helga and I were crazy about Nazis. I can't say, on the other hand, that we hated them. They were a big, enthusiastic part of our audience, important people in the society in which we lived. They were people. Only in retrospect can I think of them as trailing slime behind. To be frank, I can't think of them as doing that even now. I knew them too well as people, worked too hard in my time for their trust and applause. Too hard. Amen. Too hard. "Who are you?" I said to the man in the park.
"Let me finish my story first," he said. "So this young man, he knows there's a war coming, figures America's going to be on one side and Germany's going to be on the other. So this American, who hasn't been anything but polite to the Nazis up to then, decided to pretend he's a Nazi himself. And he stays on in Germany when war comes along, and he gets to be a very useful American spy."
"You know who I am?" I said.
"Sure," he said.
He took out his billfold, showed me a United States War Department identification card that said he was Major Frank Wirtanen, Unit Unspecified.
"And that's who I am. I'm asking you to be an American intelligence agent, Mr. Campbell."
"Oh, Christ," I said.
I said it with anger and fatalism. I slumped down. When I straightened up again, I said, "Ridiculous. No, hell no." "Well," he said, "I'm not too let down, actually. Because today isn't when you give me your final answer, anyway."
"If you imagine that I'm going home to think it over," I said, "you're mistaken. When I go home, it will be to have a fine meal with my beautiful wife, to listen to music, to make love to my wife, and to sleep like a log.
I'm not a soldier, not a political man. I'm an artist. If war comes, I won't do anything to help it along. If war comes, it'll find me still working at my peaceful trade. He shook his head.
I wish you all the luck in the world, Mr. Campbell, he said. But this war isn't going to let anybody stay in a peaceful trade. And I'm sorry to say it, he said. But the worse this Nazi thing gets, the less you're going to sleep like a log at night.
We'll see, I said tautly.
That's right, we'll see, he said. That's why I said you wouldn't give me your final answer today. You'll live your final answer. If you decide to go ahead with it, you'll go ahead with it strictly on your own, working your way up with the Nazis as high as you can go.
Charming, I said.
Well, it has this much charm to it, he said. You'd be an authentic hero, about 100 times braver than any ordinary man.
A ramrod Wehrmacht general in a fat briefcase carrying German civilian passed in front of us, talking with suppressed excitement.
Howdy do, Major Wirtanen said to them amiably.
They snorted in contempt, walked on.
You'll be volunteering right at the start of a war to be a dead man. Even if you live through the war without being caught, you'll find your reputation gone, and probably very little to live for, he said.
You make it sound very attractive, I said.
I think there's a chance I've made it attractive to you, he said. I saw the play you've got running now, and I've read the one you're going to open.
Oh, I said. And what did you learn from those?
He smiled. That you admire pure hearts and heroes, he said. That you love good and hate evil, he said. And that you believe in romance.
He didn't mention the best reason for expecting me to go on and be a spy. The best reason was that I was a ham. As a spy of the sort he described, I would have an opportunity for some pretty grand acting. I would fool everyone with my brilliant interpretation of a Nazi, inside and out. And I did fool everybody. I began to strut like Hitler's right-hand man, and nobody saw the honest me I hid so deep inside. Can I prove I was an American spy? My unbroken, lily-white neck is Exhibit A, and it's the only exhibit I have. Those whose duty it is to find me guilty or innocent of crimes against humanity are welcome to examine it in detail. The government of the United States neither confirms nor denies that I was an agent of theirs. That's a little something, anyway, that they don't deny the possibility. They twitch away that tidbit, however, by denying that a Frank Wirtanen ever served that government in any branch. Nobody believes in him but me. So I will hereinafter speak of him often as my blue fairy godmother. One of the many things my blue fairy godmother told me was the sign and countersign that would identify me to my contact and my contact to me if war should come. The sign was, make new friends. The countersign was, but keep the old. My lawyer here, the learned counsel for the defense, is a Mr. Alvin Dobrowitz. He grew up in America, something I never did, and Mr. Dobrowitz tells me that the sign and countersign are part of a song often sung by an idealistic American girls' organization called the Brownies. The full lyric, according to Mr. Dobrowitz, is, make new friends, but keep the old. One is silver, the other's gold.
Chapter 10. Romance. My wife never knew I was a spy. I would have lost nothing by telling her. My telling her wouldn't have made her love me less. My telling her wouldn't have put me in any danger. It would simply have made my heavenly Helga's world, which was already something to make the Book of Revelation, seem pedestrian.
The war was enough without that. My Helga believed that I meant the nutty things I said on the radio, said at parties. We were always going to parties. We were a very popular couple, gay and patriotic. People used to tell us that we cheered them up, made them want to go on. And Helga didn't go through the war simply looking decorative either. She entertained the troops, often within the sound of enemy guns. Enemy guns? Somebody's guns, anyway. That was how I lost her. She was entertaining troops in the Crimea, and the Russians took the Crimea back. My Helga was presumed dead. After the war, I paid a good deal of my money to a private detective agency in West Berlin to trace the wispiest word of her. Results? Zero. My standing offer to the agency, unclaimed, was a prize of $10,000 for clear proof that my Helga was either alive or dead. Hi-ho. My Helga believed I meant the things I said about the races of man and the machines of history, and I was grateful. No matter what I was really, no matter what I really meant, uncritical love was what I needed, and my Helga was the angel who gave it to me. Copiously. No young person on earth is so excellent in all respects as to need no uncritical love. Good Lord, as youngsters play their parts in political tragedies with casts of billions, uncritical love is the only real treasure they can look for. Das Reich der Zwei, the nation of two my Helga and I had, its territory, the territory we defended so jealously, didn't go much beyond the bounds of our great double bed. Flat, tufted, springy little country, with my Helga and me for mountains. And with nothing in my life making sense but love, what a student of geography I was. What a map I could draw for a tourist a micron high. A submicroscopic Wandervogel, bicycling between a mole and a curly golden hair on either side of my Helga's belly button. If this image is in bad taste, God help me. Everybody is supposed to play games for mental health. I have simply described the game, an adult interpretation of this little piggy that was ours. Oh, how we clung, my Helga and I. How mindlessly we clung. We didn't listen to each other's words. We heard only the melodies in our voices. The things we listened for carried no more intelligence than the purrs and growls of big cats. If we had listened for more, had thought about what we heard, what a nauseated couple we would have been. Away from the sovereign territory of our nation of two, we talked like the patriotic lunatics all around us. But it did not count. Only one thing counted, the nation of two. And when that nation ceased to be, I became what I am today and what I always will be, a stateless person. I can't say I wasn't warned. The man who recruited me that spring day in the Tiergarten so long ago now, that man told my fortune pretty well. To do your job right, my blue fairy godmother told me, you'll have to commit high treason. Have to serve the enemy well. You won't ever be forgiven for that, because there isn't any legal device by which you can be forgiven. The most that will be done for you, he said, is that your neck will be saved. But there will be no magic time when you will be cleared, when America will call you out of hiding with a cheerful, Ali Ali Oxen free. Chapter 11. War Surplus. My mother and father died. Some say they died of broken hearts. They died in their middle 60s at any rate, when hearts break easily. They did not live to see the end of the war, nor did they ever see their beamish boy again. They did not disinherit me, though they must have been bitterly tempted to do so. They bequeathed to Howard W. Campbell, Jr., the notorious anti-Semite, turncoat, and radio star, stocks, real estate, cash, and personal property, which were, in 1945, at the time of probate, worth $48,000. That boodle, through growth and inflation, has come to be worth four times that much now, giving me an unearned income of $7,000 a year. Say what you like about me. I have never touched my principal. During my post-war years as an odd duck and recluse in Greenwich Village, I lived on about $4 a day, rent included, and I even had a television set. My new furnishings were all war surplus, like myself. A narrow steel cot, olive drab blankets with USA on them, folding canvas chairs, mess kits to cook in and eat out of. Even my library was largely war surplus, coming as it did from recreation kits intended for troops overseas. And since phonograph records came in these unused kits too, I got myself a war surplus, weatherproofed, portable phonograph, guaranteed to play in any climate from the Bering Straits to the Arafura Sea. By buying the recreation kits, each one a sealed pig in a poke, I came into possession of 26 recordings of Bing Crosby's White Christmas. My overcoat, my raincoat, my jacket, my socks, and my underwear were war surplus too. By buying a war surplus first aid kit for a dollar, I also came into possession of a quantity of morphine. The buzzards in the war surplus business were so glutted with carrion as to have overlooked it. I was tempted to take the morphine, reflecting that, if it made me feel happy, I would, after all, have enough money to support the habit. But then I understood that I was already drugged. I was feeling no pain. My narcotic was what had got me through the war. It was an ability to let my emotions be stirred by only one thing: my love for Helga. This concentration of my emotions on so small an area had begun as a young lover's happy illusion, had developed into a device to keep me from going insane during the war, and had finally become the permanent axis about which my thoughts revolved. And so, with my Helga presumed dead, I became a death worshipper, as content as any narrow-minded religious nut anywhere. Always alone, I drank toasts to her, said good morning to her, said good night to her, played music for her, and didn't give a damn for one thing else. And then one day in 1958, after 13 years of living like that, I bought a war surplus wood carving set. It was surplus not from the Second World War, but from the Korean War. It cost me $3. When I got it home, I started to carve up my broom handle to no particular purpose. And it suddenly occurred to me to make a chess set. I speak of suddenness here, because I was startled to find myself with an enthusiasm. I was so enthusiastic that I carved for 12 hours straight, sank sharp tools into the palm of my left hand a dozen times, and still would not stop. I was an elated, gory mess when I was finished. I had a handsome set of chessmen to show for my labors. And yet another strange impulse came upon me. I felt compelled to show somebody, somebody still among the living, the marvelous thing I had made. So, made boisterous by both creativity and drink, I went downstairs and banged on the door of my neighbor, not even knowing who my neighbor was. My neighbor was a foxy old man named George Kraft. That was only one of his names. The real name of this old man was Colonel Iona Potapov. This antique son of a bitch was a Russian agent, had been operating continuously in America since 1935. I didn't know that, and he didn't know at first who I was either. It was dumb luck that brought us together. No conspiracy was involved at first. It was I who knocked on his door, invaded his privacy. If I hadn't carved that chess set, we never would have met. Kraft, and I'll call him that from now on because that's how I think of him, had 3 or 4 locks on his front door. I induced him to unlock them all by asking him if he played chess. There was dumb luck again. Nothing else would have made him open up. People helping me with my research later, incidentally, tell me that the name of Iona Potapov was a familiar one in European chess tournaments in the early 30s. He actually beat the Grand Master Tartakover in Rotterdam in 1931. When he opened up, I saw that he was a painter. There was an easel in the middle of his living room with a fresh canvas on it, and there were stunning paintings by him on every wall. When I talk about Kraft, alias Potapov, I'm a lot more comfortable than when I talk about Wirtanen, alias God knows what. Wirtanen has left no more of a trail than an inchworm crossing a billiard table. Evidences of Kraft are everywhere. At this very moment, I'm told, Kraft's paintings are bringing as much as $10,000 apiece in New York. I have at hand a clipping from the New York Herald Tribune of March 3rd, about 2 weeks ago, in which a critic says of Kraft as a painter, "Here at last is a capable and grateful heir to the fantastic inventiveness and experimentation in painting during the past 100 years. Aristotle is said to have been the last man to understand the whole of his culture. George Kraft is surely the first man to understand the whole of modern art, to understand it in his sinews and bones. With incredible grace and firmness, he combines the visions of a score of warring schools of painting, past and present. He thrills and humbles us with harmony, seems to say to us, if you want another Renaissance, this is what the paintings expressing its spirit will look like." George Kraft, alias Iona Potapov, is being permitted to continue his remarkable art career in the federal penitentiary at Fort Leavenworth. We all might well reflect, along, no doubt, with Kraft Potapov himself, on how summarily his career would have been crushed in a prison in his native Russia. Well, when Kraft opened his door for me, I knew his paintings were good. I didn't know they were that good. I suspect that the review above was written by a pansy full of Brandy Alexanders. "I didn't know I had a painter living underneath me," I said to Kraft.
"Maybe you don't have one," he said.
"Marvelous paintings," I said. "Where do you exhibit?"
"I never have," he said.
"You'd make a fortune if you did," I said.
"You're nice to say so," he said. "But I started painting too late."
He then told me what was supposed to be the story of his life, none of it true. He said he was a widower from Indianapolis. As a young man, he said, he'd wanted to be an artist, but he'd gone into business instead, the paint and wallpaper business.
"My wife died 2 years ago," he said.
And he managed to look a little moist around the eyes. He had a wife, all right, but not underground in Indianapolis. He had a very live wife named Tanya in Borisoglebsk. He hadn't seen her for 25 years.
"When she died," he said to me, "I found my spirit wanted to choose between only 2 things, suicide or the dreams I'd had in my youth. I am an old fool who borrowed the dreams of a young fool. I bought myself some canvas and paint, and I came to Greenwich Village."
"No children?" I said.
"None," he said sadly.
He actually had 3 children and 9 grandchildren. His oldest son, Ilya, is a famous rocket expert.
"The only relative I've got in this world is art," he said. "And I'm the poorest relative art ever had."
He didn't mean he was impoverished. He meant he was a bad painter. He had plenty of money, he told me. He'd sold his business in Indianapolis, he said, for a very good price.
"Chess," he said. "You said something about chess?"
I had the chessmen I'd whittled in a shoebox. I showed them to him. "I just made these," I said. and now I've got a terrific yen to play with them.
Pride yourself on your game, do you?
He asked. I haven't played for a good while, I said. Almost all the chess I'd played had been with Werner Noth, my father-in-law, the chief of police of Berlin. I used to beat Noth pretty consistently on Sunday afternoons when my Helga and I went calling on him. The only tournament I ever played in was an intramural thing in the German Ministry for Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda. I finished 11th in a field of 65. In ping-pong, I did a good deal better. I was ping-pong champion of the ministry for 4 years running, singles and doubles. My doubles partner was Heinz Schildknecht, an expert at propagandizing Australians and New Zealanders. One time, Heinz and I took on a doubles team composed of Reichsleiter Goebbels and Oberdienstleiter Karl Hedrick. We sat them down 21-2, 21-1, 21-0. History often goes hand in hand with sports. Kraft had a chessboard. We set up my men on it, and we began to play. And the thick, bristly, olive-drab cocoon I had built for myself was frayed a little, was weakened enough to let some pale light in. I enjoyed the game, was able to come up with enough intuitively interesting moves to give my new friend entertainment while he beat me. After that, Kraft and I played at least 3 games a day every day for a year, and we built up between ourselves a pathetic sort of domesticity that we both felt need of. We began tasting our food again, making little discoveries in grocery stores, bringing them home to share. When strawberries came in season, I remember, Kraft and I whooped it up as though Jesus had returned. One particularly touching thing between us was the matter of wines. Kraft knew a lot more than I did about wines, and he often brought home cobwebby treasures to go with a meal. But even though Kraft always had a filled glass before him when we sat down to eat, the wine was all for me. Kraft was an alcoholic. He could not take so much as a sip of wine without starting on a bender that could last a month. That much of what he told me about himself was true. He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, had been for 16 years. While he used AA meetings as spy drops, his appetite for what the meetings offered spiritually was real. He once told me, in all sincerity, that the greatest contribution America had made to the world, a contribution that would be remembered for thousands of years, was the invention of AA. It was typical of his schizophrenia as a spy that he would use an institution he so admired for purposes of espionage. It was typical of his schizophrenia as a spy that he should also be a true friend of mine, and that he should eventually think of a way to use me cruelly in advancing the Russian cause.